Chapter 25. At Marseille Again. Daylight, for which Dantès had so eagerly and impatiently waited, again dawned upon the desert shores of Monte Cristo. With the first dawn of day, Dantès resumed his researches. Again he climbed the rocky height he had ascended the previous evening, and strained his view to catch every peculiarity of the landscape. But it wore the same wild, barren aspect when seen by the rays of the morning sun, which it had done when surveyed by the fading glimmer of eve. Returning to the entrance of the cave, he raised the stone that covered it, and descending to the place that contained the treasure, filled his pockets with precious stones, put the box together as well and securely as he could, sprinkled fresh sand over the spot from which it had been taken, and then carefully trod down the ground, to give it everywhere a similar appearance. Then quitting the grotto, he replaced the stone, heaping on it broken masses of rocks and rough fragments of crumbling granite, filling the interstices with earth, into which was skilfully mingled a quantity of rapidly growing plants, such as the wild myrtle and flowering thorn. Then carefully watering these new plantations, he scrupulously effaced every trace of footmark, leaving the approach to the cavern as savage-looking and untrodden as he had found it. This done, he impatiently awaited the return of his companions. To wait at Monte Cristo, for the purpose of watching over the most incalculable riches that had thus fallen into his possession, satisfied not the cravings of his heart, which yearned to return to dwell among mankind, and to assume the rank, power, and influence unbounded wealth alone can bestow. On the sixth day, the smugglers returned. From a distance, Dantès recognized the cut and manner of sailing of the young Amelia, and dragging himself with affected difficulty towards the landing-place, he met his companions with an assurance that, although considerably better than when they quitted him, he still suffered acutely from his late accident. He then inquired how they had fared in their trip. To this question the smugglers replied that, although successful in landing their cargo in safety, they had scarcely done so when they received intelligence that a guard-ship had just quitted the port of Toulon and was crowding all sail towards them. This obliged them to make all the speed they could to evade the enemy. When they could but lament the absence of Dantès, whose superior skill in the management of a vessel would have availed them so materially. In fact, the chasing vessel had almost overtaken them when, fortunately, night came on, and enabled them to double the Cape of Corsica, and so elude all further pursuit. Upon the whole, however, the trip had been sufficiently successful to satisfy all concerned, while the crew, and particularly Jacopo, expressed great regrets at Dantès not having been an equal sharer with themselves in the profits, amounting to no less a sum than 50 piastres each. Edmund preserved the most admirable self-command, not suffering the faintest indication of a smile to escape him at the enumeration of all the benefits he would have reaped had he been able to quit the isle. But as the young Amelia had merely come to Monte Cristo to fetch him away, he embarked that same evening and proceeded with the captain to Leghorn. Arrived at Leghorn, he repaired to the house of a Jew, a dealer in precious stones, to whom he disposed of 4 of his smallest diamonds for 5,000 francs each. Dantès half feared that such valuable jewels in the hands of a poor sailor like himself might excite suspicion. But the cunning purchaser asked no troublesome questions concerning a bargain by which he gained at least 4,000 francs. The following day, Dantès presented Jacopo with an entirely new vessel, accompanying the gift by a donation of 100 piastres, that he might provide himself with a suitable crew and other requisites for his outfit, upon conditions of his going direct to Marseille for the purpose of inquiring after an old man named Louis Dantès, residing in the Allée de Meillan, and also a young female called Mercedes, an inhabitant of the Catalan village. Jacopo could scarcely believe his senses at receiving this munificent present, which Dantès hastened to account for by saying that he had merely been a sailor from whim, and a desire to spite his friends, who did not allow him as much money as he liked to spend, but that on his arrival at Leghorn he had come into possession of a large fortune left him by an uncle, whose sole heir he was. The superior education of Dantès gave an air of such extreme probability to this statement that it never once occurred to Jacopo to doubt its accuracy. The term for which Edmund had engaged to serve on board the young Amelia having expired, Dantès took leave of the captain, who at first tried all his powers of persuasion to induce him to remain one of the crew. but having been told the history of the legacy, he ceased to importune him further. The succeeding morning, Jacopo set sail for Marseille, with directions from Dantès to rejoin him at the island of Monte Cristo. Having seen Jacopo fairly out of the harbour, Dantès proceeded to make his final adieus on board the young Amelia. He distributed so liberal a gratuity among her crew as procured him unanimous good wishes and expressions of cordial interest in all that concerned him. To the captain he promised to write when he had made up his mind as to his future plans. This leave-taking over, Dantès departed for Genoa. At the moment of his arrival, a small yacht was being tried in the bay. This yacht had been built by order of an Englishman who, having heard that the Genoese excelled all other builders along the shores of the Mediterranean in the construction of fast-sailing vessels, was desirous of possessing a specimen of their skill. The price agreed upon between the Englishman and Genoese builder was 40,000 francs. Dantès, struck with the beauty and capability of the little vessel, applied to its owner to transfer it to him, offering 60,000 francs, upon condition of being allowed to take immediate possession of it. The proposal was too advantageous to be refused, the more so as the person for whom the yacht was intended had gone upon a tour through Switzerland, and was not expected back in less than 3 weeks or a month, by which time the builder reckoned upon being able to complete another. A bargain was therefore struck. Dantès led the owner of the yacht to the dwelling of a Jew, retired with the latter individual for a few minutes to a small back parlour, and upon their return the Jew counted out to the shipbuilder the sum of 60,000 francs in bright golden money. The delighted builder then offered his services in providing a suitable crew for the little vessel, but this Dantès declined, with many thanks, saying he was accustomed to cruise about quite alone, and his principal pleasure consisted in managing his yacht himself. The only thing the builder could oblige him in would be to contrive a sort of secret closet in the cabin at his bed's head, the closet to contain 3 divisions, so constructed as to be concealed from all but himself. The builder cheerfully undertook the commission, and promised to have these secret places completed by the next day, Dantès furnishing the size and plan upon which he desired they should be arranged. The following day Dantès sailed with his yacht from the port of Genoa amid the gaze of an immense crowd drawn together by curiosity to see the rich Spanish nobleman who preferred managing his vessel himself. But their wonder was soon exchanged for admiration at the perfect skill with which Dantès handled the helm, and without quitting it making his little vessel perform every movement he chose to direct. His bark seemed indeed animated with all but human intelligence, so promptly did it obey the slightest impulse given, and Dantès required but a short trial of his beautiful craft to acknowledge that it was not without truth the Genoese had attained their high reputation in the art of shipbuilding. The spectators followed the little vessel with their eyes so long as it remained visible. They then turned their conjectures upon her probable destination. Some insisted she was making for Corsica, others the Isle of Elba. Bets were offered to any amount that she was bound for Spain, while Africa was positively reported by many persons as her intended course, but no one thought of Monte Cristo. Yet thither it was that Dantès guided his vessel, and at Monte Cristo he arrived at the close of the second day. His bark had proved herself a first-class sailor, and had come the distance from Genoa in 35 hours. Dantès had carefully noted the general appearance of the shore, and instead of landing at the usual place, he dropped anchor in the little creek. The isle was utterly deserted, nor did it seem as though human foot had trodden on it since he quitted it. His treasure was just as he had left it. Early on the following morning he commenced the removal of his riches, and ere nightfall the whole of his immense wealth was safely deposited in the secret compartments of his hidden closet. A week passed by. Dantès employed it in manoeuvring his yacht round the island, studying it as a skilful horseman would the animal he destined for some important service, till at the end of that time he was perfectly conversant with its good and bad qualities. The former Dantès proposed to augment, the latter to remedy. Upon the 8th day of his being on the island, he discerned a small vessel crowding all sail towards Monte Cristo. As it neared, he recognized it as the bark he had given to Jacopo. He immediately signaled it, his signal was returned, and in 2 hours afterwards the bark lay at anchor beside the yacht. A mournful answer awaited each of Edmund's eager inquiries as to the information Jacopo had obtained. old Dantes was dead, and Mercedes had disappeared. Dantes listened to these melancholy tidings with outward calmness, but leaping lightly ashore, he signified his desire to be quite alone. In a couple of hours he returned. Two of the men from Jacopo's bark came on board the yacht to assist in navigating it, and he commanded she should be steered direct to Marseille. For his father's death he was in some manner prepared, but how to account for the mysterious disappearance of Mercedes he knew not. Without divulging his secret, Dantes could not give sufficiently clear instructions to an agent. There were, besides, other particulars he was desirous of ascertaining, and those were of a nature he alone could investigate in a manner satisfactory to himself. His looking-glass had assured him during his stay at Leghorn that he ran no risk of recognition, added to which he had now the means of adopting any disguise he thought proper. One fine morning, then, his yacht, followed by the little bark, boldly entered the port of Marseille, and anchored exactly opposite the memorable spot from whence, on the never-to-be-forgotten night of his departure for the Chateau d'If, he had been put on board the vessel destined to convey him thither. Still, Dantes could not view without a shudder the approach of a gendarme who accompanied the officers deputed to demand his bill of health, ere the yacht was permitted to hold communication with the shore. But with that perfect self-possession he had acquired during his acquaintance with Faria, Dantes coolly presented an English passport he had obtained from Leghorn, and with that prompt attention which all such English documents receive, he was informed there existed no obstacle to his immediate debarkation. The first object that attracted the attention of Dantes as he landed on the Canebière was one of the crew belonging to the Pharaon. Edmund hailed the appearance of this man, who had served under himself, as a sure test of the safe and perfect change time had worked in his own appearance. Going straight towards him, he commenced a variety of questions on different subjects, carefully watching the man's countenance as he did so. But not a word or look implied his having the slightest idea of ever having seen before the individual with whom he was then conversing. Giving the sailor a piece of money in return for his civility, Dantes proceeded onwards, but ere he had gone many steps he heard the man loudly calling him to stop. Dantes instantly turned to meet him.
"I beg your pardon, sir," said the honest fellow, in almost breathless haste. "But I believe you made a mistake. You intended to give me a 2-franc piece, and see, you gave me a double Napoleon."
"Thank you, my good friend. I see that I made a trifling mistake, as you say, but by way of rewarding your honest spirit, I give you another double Napoleon, that you may drink to my health, and be able to ask your messmates to join you." So extreme was the surprise of the sailor that he was unable even to thank Edmund, whose receding figure he continued to gaze after in speechless astonishment. At length, when Dantes had wholly disappeared, he drew a deep breath, and with another look at his gold he returned to the quay, saying to himself,
"Ah, that's one of them nabob gentlemen from Inge, no doubt. Nobody else could afford to chuck gold about like that. Well, he said I was to drink to his health, and so I will, with all my heart."
Dantes, meanwhile, continued his route. Each step he trod oppressed his heart with fresh emotion. His first and most indelible recollections were there. Not a tree, not a street that he passed, but seemed filled with dear and cherished reminiscences. And thus he proceeded onwards till he arrived at the end of Rue de Noailles, whence a full view of the Allée de Meillan was obtained. At this spot, so pregnant with fond and filial remembrances, his heart beat almost to bursting, his knees tottered under him, a misty vapour floated over his sight, and had he not clung for support to one of the trees, he would inevitably have fallen to the ground and been crushed beneath the many vehicles continually passing there. Recovering himself, however, he wiped the perspiration from his brows, and stopped not again till he found himself at the door of the house in which his father had lived. The nasturtiums and other plants, which his parent had delighted to train before his window, had all disappeared from the upper part of the house.
End of Disc 7. Disc 8.
The nasturtiums and other plants, which his parent had delighted to train before his window, had all disappeared from the upper part of the house. Leaning against a tree, he remained long gazing on those windows at which the busy hand of the active old man might be daily seen training and arranging his floral treasures. But Edmund remembered he had come thither for other reasons than to indulge a grief now, alas, unavailing. And, stifling the deep sigh that rose to his lips, he advanced to the door, and inquired whether there were any chambers to be let in the house. Though answered in the negative, he begged so earnestly to be permitted to visit those on the fifth floor that, in spite of the concierge's oft-repeated assurance of their being occupied, Dantès succeeded in inducing the man to go up to the present possessors of these coveted rooms and ask permission for a gentleman to be allowed to look at them. The tenants of the humble lodging, once the scene of all Dantès' early joys, consisted of a young couple who had been scarcely married a week, and the sight of a wedded happiness he was doomed never to experience drove a bitter pang through his heart. Nothing in the two small chambers forming the apartments remained as it had been in the time of the elder Dantès. The very paper was different, while the articles of antiquated furniture with which the rooms had been filled in Edmund's time had all disappeared. The four walls alone remained as he had left them. The bed belonging to the present occupants was placed as the former owner of the chamber had been accustomed to have his, and, spite of his efforts to prevent it, the eyes of Edmund were suffused in tears as he reflected that on that spot his beloved parent had expired, vainly calling for his son. The young couple gazed with astonishment at the sight of their visitor's emotion, and wondered to see the large tears silently chase each other down his otherwise stern and immovable features. But they felt the sacredness of his grief, and kindly refrained from questioning him as to its cause, while, with instinctive delicacy, they left him to indulge his sorrow alone. When he withdrew from the scene of his painful recollections, they both accompanied him downstairs, reiterating their hope that he would come again whenever he pleased, and assuring him their poor dwelling should ever be open to him. As Edmund passed the door of similar rooms on the fourth floor, he paused to inquire whether Caderousse, the tailor, still dwelt there, but he received for reply that the individual in question had got into difficulties, and at the present time kept a small inn on the route from Bellegarde to Beaucaire. Having obtained the address of the person to whom the house in the Allée de Meilhan belonged, Dantès next proceeded thither, and under the name of Lord Wilmore, the same appellation as that contained in his passport, purchased the small dwelling for the sum of 25,000 francs, at least 10,000 more than it was worth, but had its owner asked 10 times the sum he did, it would unhesitatingly have been given. The very same day the occupants of the apartments on the fifth floor of the house, now the property of Dantès, were duly informed by the notary, who had arranged the necessary transfer of deeds, etc., that the new landlord gave them their choice of any of the rooms in the house without the least augmentation of rent, upon condition of their giving instant possession of the two small chambers they at present inhabited. This strange event served to find food for wonder and curiosity in the neighbourhood of the Allée de Meilhan, and a multitude of various conjectures were afloat as to the probable cause of the house being so suddenly and mysteriously disposed of. But each surmise seemed to wander farther and farther from the real truth. But that which raised public astonishment to a climax, and set all speculations at defiance, was the circumstance of the same stranger who had in the morning visited the Allée de Meilhan, being seen in the evening walking in the little village of the Catalans, and afterwards observed to enter a poor fisherman's hut, and to pass more than an hour in inquiring after persons who had either been dead or gone away for more than 15 or 16 years. But on the following day, the family from whom all these particulars had been asked received a handsome present, consisting of an entirely new fishing boat with a full supply of excellent nets. The delighted recipients of these munificent gifts would gladly have poured out their thanks to their generous benefactor, but they had seen him, upon quitting the hut, merely give some orders to a sailor, and then, springing lightly on horseback, quit Marseille by the Porte d'Aix.